Welcome to episode 8 of the Olasky Interview. I'm your host, Jill Nelson. Today we'll hear Marvin's 2017 interview with political strategist Michael Ware. Ware is the founder of Public Square Strategies. He's a leading expert at the intersection of faith, politics, and American public life. Ware was one of the youngest White House staffers in modern American history. He served in the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives during President Obama's first term. There, he led evangelical outreach and helped manage efforts to end human trafficking. After leaving the White House, Ware wrote a book about his experience. Reclaiming Hope, Lessons Learned at the Obama White House gives an unvarnished account of faith inside the world's most powerful office. Ware now serves on the National Board of Bethany Christian Services, the nation's largest adoption agency. He also holds an honorary position at the University of Birmingham Cadbury's Center for the Public Understanding of Religion. Marvin Olasky joins us now to set up this interview with Michael Ware. Hi, Marvin.
Hi, Jill.
Well, Michael Ware's experience in politics is fascinating, in part because it started when he was so young. At 20 years old, he was the youngest person to ever work at the White House. Is that one of the reasons you wanted to talk to him?
One of the reasons. And for a young guy, he's impressive because coming out of the White House now, he's not burning bridges, but he's also not desperate to please. I asked him, for example, about Barack Obama's switch on same-sex marriage. And Michael said that if Obama on the campaign trail in 2008 was lying about his position, that's really troubling. So he's trying to maintain a delicate balance, not dumping on the folks he worked with and for, but at the same time trying to tell the truth.
What are some of the lessons we can learn from Ware's story of having so much influence at such a young age?
Be careful not to have so much influence at such a young age. He, I think, learned a whole lot. And perhaps if he gets back in such a position at some point, that'll be extraordinarily useful to him. But now he realizes how immature he was in some ways. And I like that sense of proud of what he accomplished, but also realizing a lot of other things that he didn't accomplish and gaining some wisdom in the process. And I think it comes back to when Michael became a Christian as a teenager. He read Paul's letter to the Romans, studied it, and suddenly understood what the gospel is all about. God saves sinners, and I suspect in 8 years in the White House, you learn that not just other people are sinners, but you yourself are also a sinner. So it was a great education to have, and I think he gained that education not at a huge amount of public expense, because I suspect within the Obama administration, he was doing its best to keep it from heading in a really radical direction.
You allude in the interview that Ware's experience is similar to yours with the Bush administration. Talk a little bit about that.
Two reasons I very much enjoyed talking with Michael. Number one, theologically, I went through that same experience of just being blown away by Paul's letter to the Romans. And that changed my life, my understanding. But secondly, Michael's experience was similar to mine in being disappointed by some things. But I was always operating as a journalist. I was an informal advisor to Governor Bush, and my main effort was always with World. Michael had a lot more stake. This was his career, and I think came out of it probably somewhat disappointed, but very mature now in his analysis of politics and what to expect from it and what politics can't give us.
So, Marvin, what else about Ware's story and experience stood out to you?
Well, I've wondered for a long time why the Democratic Party is so politically stupid in this sense. Seems to me that if the Democratic Party had not become so radically pro-abortion, Democrats would have won the presidency in 1980, in 2000, probably 2016 as well. So the question that I wonder about, what keeps the Democratic Party from doing what political parties normally do, that is adjusting their positions at certain times in order to win? What I heard from Michael was that when we have the White House, an ideological calcification goes on. When you've won, you don't want to change. Same thing happens when Republicans are in control, and so the Democrats keep coming back to the same mistake. When they're in the White House, they think they can maintain it without having to change a position that really goes against what most Americans believe about abortion. And it's a tragedy for so many preborn, unborn children that Democrats won't change, even though political shrewdness might indicate that. But listening to Michael, I understand more about what happens once you're in the White House, once you're in control. You don't want to change. You think you can keep on doing the same old, and people will come to you rather than you're adjusting your position, even if not for ethical reasons, at least for political reasons.
Marvin Alasky is editor-in-chief at World. Marvin, thank you.
Thank you, Jill.
The Alasky Interview is made possible by listeners like you. Additional support comes from Crown and Covenant Publications, publisher of the new book, God Breathed, by Rutt Etheridge III, connecting through Scripture to God, others, the natural world, and yourself. Available at crownandcovenant.com and on audiobook platforms.
Here now is Marvin's 2017 interview with political strategist Michael Ware.
I grew up in a kind of Catholic home, but not really belief, more ritual. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I tell people my favorite saints growing up were the saints associated with the food I liked. And so St. Joseph's Table is coming up, and I liked St. Joseph because of Sphingi, but that's not really the most theologically reflective faith. But, you know, my grandfather would say that it was the Lord who saw him through World War II, and my aunts would pray their rosary. But as a young person perceiving what I perceived was that it wasn't a faith that everyone seemed Catholic. It was a Catholicism of fish fries and those kinds of things. And it wasn't something that penetrated my heart, certainly.
Yeah. Okay. And your elder sister was actually the evangelist toward you.
She was. She became a Christian a few years before I did and started working on me immediately. It was like a homing missile. And she'd always try and sit me down and go over scripture with me and, you know, have conversations. And it actually built up quite an antagonism. Sort of from my perspective, she finally got me to go to her youth group. And I thought, okay, I'll go to the youth group and I'll just get some more ammunition so I can make fun of her and tell her how silly all of this is. And went to the youth group and didn't like it at all. But on my way out of the youth group, a volunteer there, this guy by the name of Joe Vacani.
What kind of youth group was this?
So it was a church-based. So it was a youth group, high school, run by the church that would end up being my church, my sister's church.
Which was?
The chapel.
Okay.
So it's a church in Buffalo. It was founded by Dr. James Andrews and is a thriving kind of mega church environment in Buffalo.
And evangelical? So,
yes, evangelical, non-denominational, but okay. The pastors are all trained Southern Baptists, but we're in Buffalo, so who wants a Southern Baptist church in Buffalo? So. So end up at this youth group, and on my way out, this volunteer by the name of Joe Vacani is handing out tracts of Romans, just Romans, no commentary, just Paul's letter. And I took it home and read it again, and it changed my life. 72 hours later, my sister was dropping me off from school, and in her car outside of her house, I told her I gave my life to Christ. And, you know, Romans is a perfect antidote to someone who thinks there's no there when it comes to Christianity. Mm-hmm. Like, you can reject Paul's argument after you read Romans, but you can no longer say that there is no argument, that there is no case, that the Christian faith isn't a holistic view of the world that you must contend with, and I had to contend with it.
A holistic view. What really hit you in it, as you recall?
I had felt like I had never heard any of it before. I didn't understand sort of the logic of it. So, you know, we knew that, you know, Easter, that, you know, Jesus died and rose again. Why? Why did they have to have, well, the wages of sin is death. Why don't Christians all act like Jesus all the time? Well, it's because I do not do what I want to do. And what does it mean to enter into this life? Well, you confess with your mouth and believe in your heart that, and it was that scope that Paul offers in Romans that, as I write in the book, it's a bit of a longer, so I had some introduction to sort of gospel themes through music, and of course, there was a logical argument that engaged me, but it was a move of the Holy Spirit in my life. So those were some of the things that sort of moved me.
And you're also becoming interested in politics at this time as well?
Well, so my interest in politics kind of predated all of that. My grandfather was Greatest Generation, World War II, fought in Normandy, came back, served his community. We weren't a very political family, but civically minded. And so I was interested in politics, frankly, before I was interested in faith. So when I became a Christian, I thought, well, now I have to go to seminary, become a pastor, because what else would a good Christian do? But I had a good pastor, had good people in my life, and decided I wanted to see what it meant to be faithful in public things, what faithfulness looked like in public areas. Part of the reason why that was important to me, when I became a Christian, it was just when we were starting to have sort of the data and the evidence that the public, the American public in general, was kind of turning on the Christian faith, that Gabe Lyon's book on Christian came out, Putnam and Campbell's book, Amazing Grace, American Grace came out, mm-hmm. that showed that that not just, I think we often talk about how faith influences politics. What was very apparent to me from the moment I became a Christian was how politics was affecting our faith. So when I first became a Christian, I wanted to tell everyone about Jesus in the Southern Baptist tradition. Like we call it ignorance on fire. I wanted to tell everyone about Jesus, even though I knew very little about him. But and I'd go tell my friends, you know, I want to tell you about something that's happened in my life. And they'd say, oh, so that means you're going to be judgmental now, or does that mean we can't be friends anymore, or are you going to, like, be mean? And that struck this thing that I was very excited about, that was a very positive thing in my life. All of a sudden, came the understanding that for my peers, it was this very negative, oppressing thing, and a big reason for that was sort of the public witness of the faith as perceived in politics.
So when we read, for example, right in Romans 1, you know, that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, you're all, as you're reading that, you're also, I suspect, thinking politically to some extent, or what difference that makes in what individuals should do, what government should do. How did this all wrap up?
Wow. It took a while to right. You know, right. when I left the youth group and read Romans, I wasn't thinking about right. politics. Right. I think a few things changed, right? So I had an understanding of human life as created that had to influence my view on politics. Okay. I had a view of compassion and justice that had to infuse my politics, and I had a view that politics could no longer be ultimate. Okay. That sort of the as is a major theme in my book, that sort of the prime mover in history is not politics and political actors, but Jesus. And so all those things sort of, but at various stages of my life, and obviously I'm still growing and learning and today.
Yeah. Okay, and so then you go off to George Washington University.
That's right.
Why George Washington University?
It was right in the thick of things.
Okay. So you wanted to be in Washington?
I wanted to be in Washington. College is so... I looked at some other schools that were closer, but the price tags were all so inconceivable to me that my basic idea was, if I'm going to do this at all, I don't want to be studying politics in anywhere but D.C. Okay. And so yeah, I ended up at George Washington University. I visited the campus, and you know, it's right 3 blocks from the White House, 3 mm-hmm. blocks from the State Department, and so it was an exciting place to study.
And in your freshman year, you join and actually become a leader in the Young Democrats.
Yeah, the College Democrats.
Okay, so in the College Democrats. So yeah, why gravitated to the Democrats as opposed to Republicans or something else?
Yeah, so I didn't become I had been a Democrat or affiliated with the Democratic Party before I went to college. A few reasons for that. One, I think clearly it's just a family history. My grandfather was a union, sure. Union guy, so FDR Democrats. Second, probably my first substantive sort of policy issue in terms of the things things that I cared about were civil rights issues and voting rights and so the Democratic Party spoke often and significantly about things like protecting the Voting Rights Act and advancing racial equality, and so that was attractive to me. I think the time I was born and just the age I was played a factor. If it was 10 years earlier, I might not have been a Democrat. If it was 10 years later, my political coming of age, and then my, as I alluded to earlier, sort of once I became a Christian, came at sort of the tail end of the religious right, and sort of, I think, a firmer sort of coming to terms with the downsides of that movement as opposed to the good things that it brought to our politics and to the national, to the nation. And so sort of the stage of the intersection of religion and politics when I was making these decisions kind of led me to the Democratic Party.
Yeah, that makes sense. And this is right at the tail end of the Bush administration.
That's right.
You're in Washington. You tell the story about how you go to a hotel for a conference, and you find out it's the wrong day. But it turned out providential. Maybe tell people about that.
Yeah. So I was supposed to be leading a group to the Washington Hilton for the Democratic winter convention in 2007, and I get to the hotel, and it was my first convention, so I wasn't too shocked when I got there and there wasn't a huge kind of hubbub. I just kind of thought I'd walk around and open a ballroom door and the convention would be there. But after 10, 15 minutes, I started thinking, well, maybe I better ask somebody and ask the receptionist. And she goes, oh, honey, that's not for another couple of days. I'm dejected and embarrassed, and I am leaving to exit the hotel, and Barack Obama is walking through the hotel lobby for meetings the day or two before the Democratic convention, before the winter convention. It was about a week before he announced he was running, and so he didn't have Secret Service around him. There wasn't a huge crowd of folks trying to get his attention. He basically walked directly up to me, and I had followed his career for a number of years. And I told him I wanted to work for him. I said I thought he was probably going to run for president, and that that I wanted to work for him. And he connected me with some staff, and you know, as 10 months later, I was in Iowa for the Iowa caucus.
So when you met him, was it love at first sight?
I don't know about that. He was someone. You know, he went to the 2004 Democratic Convention where we were nominating particularly religiously inept nominee. I think John Kerry would say this, but his campaign manager said it publicly, which is that his failure to effectively navigate religious issues was a primary reason for his loss in 2004. But it was at the convention nominating him that Barack Obama talks about the awesome God we serve in the blue states and talks about the fact that I am my brother's keeper. And so that perked me up a little bit. And then he went to, in 2006, he gave a speech rejecting secularist idea that we should take faith out of our public debates, as he called it, a practical absurdity. And so I had seen him in ways that were pretty bold and unconventional advance a positive vision for faith at a time when there were a lot of negative narratives about faith in this country. And so when I met him in that hotel, it wasn't like If it had been Hillary Clinton walking through the lobby, I wouldn't have had that same conversation. I had a pre-existing sort of that's why it was so out of all people.
So, and there you're following him. He announces. He starts running, and there you are, still a teenager. Much more fun to be in Iowa, even when it's very cold. You're used to that from Buffalo, but much, much more fun, more interesting, more educational aspect than just sitting in the classroom.
That's right. Yeah. And so I got out to Iowa about a month before the caucus, I think, maybe a little less. And when you get that close to a caucus, everyone is just complete sort of knock on doors, make sure people get to the polls. But after that, after those few weeks in Iowa, I started doing religious outreach pretty early on. As I talk about in the book, I had to, because of a complicated financial issue with my college, I actually left the campaign in January and fortunately was able to get back on in May. But I was doing faith outreach basically from the start. And it's with Barack Obama's campaign, it's important to he had such a short history in political office that, unlike not just Clinton but Biden and Dodd and the other candidates in that race, John Edwards, who had run for president before, he didn't have a huge staff, a huge stable of people to pull from. And so it was working on that campaign. If you were responsible, and to be clear, I was an intern on the first campaign, but even at that level, if you were responsible, if you got the job done, if people could count on you, you were able to... you're able to really be a part of the operation. So I learned a ton in that experience.
So you're unpaid,
yeah.
Right? But I mean, someone's paying just for the hotel room or food and stuff like that.
Yeah. So I was staying with campaign supporters. So the way it works in political campaigns, if they max out in donations, right. they could allow some an intern to live with them as a way to further contribute. Yeah.
Okay. But still, very much a labor of love and enthusiasm and excitement, and then your candidate's on a roll.
Well, right.
And so. And basically, while still a teenager, you then have, in essence, an invitation to the inner ring, to use C.S. Lewis's.
Right.
I mean, and the reason I say that is because I can just imagine the excitement and temptation. I mean, I had a little bit of that in my 40s,
yeah.
You know, and it was still interesting, and I was a little bit skeptical, more skeptical perhaps than young, but I, you know, felt that, and, yeah. And I just, you know, at age 19, age 20.
I think, and I want to sort of be, you know, for a lot of people who get to the White House, it's after decades of sort of strategizing, and so there was a certain part of it where, frankly, I didn't have much time to process. It wasn't something that I had my eye on. I mean, I, obviously, you know, you know, once you get to October, you start thinking about what might be next. But it wasn't something when I met Barack Obama in the lobby of that hotel room, I could not even have fathomed what the next, you know, 5-6 years of my life would look like. In some ways, that was very helpful. So when I got to the White House, it was very much, well, first I was in the faith-based office, which meant that I got to work directly with religious leaders and organizations that were serving those in need. So I wasn't in the communications office. I wasn't sort of, my job was working with and representing religious folks. And so that took some of the edge off and some of the things that could have been there. And then the other interesting thing about working in the White House, which is different even from working on the Hill, or is that there's a defined time horizon that you know you only have a limited amount of time to get hopefully some good work done. And so there's I think there's a healthy pressure and tension involved there.
Yeah, and did you feel a little bit like Cinderella, or you know perhaps as in My Fair Lady, that you wanted to sing, you know, I could have danced all night,
right?
Tell us about the emotions there.
Well, yeah. I was on the street where Barack Obama lived. Uh-huh. That's My Fair Lady. Sorry.
Okay.
It
soon to be a major musical.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You know, it was an honor and a privilege to work there. You never forget. You can't forget that you're working in the White House. Yeah. Sort of, you never quite get used to it. But honestly, I didn't have much time to sort of gawk around and sort of. It was very. Remember when we entered the White House, we were in the middle of the greatest economic catastrophe in the last 60, 70 years. We were trying to figure out what a faith-based office would look like, was that there wasn't much precedent for. It had only been only operated under one other administration, and so it was frankly there was too much work done to be too kind of googly-eyed about the whole thing.
So you certainly thought, I mean, based on what candidate Obama and then President Obama speaking, he sounded some biblical themes. I mean, so you, it sounds like from the book that you really thought, you know, here's a place where my political goals, my religious goals, it all comes together.
Mm.
Was that?
No, so I think I say, I think very early on, right, so one of the things I came to terms with pretty early on after I became a Christian is that I was never going to be comfortable in politics again.
Okay.
So it was funny. I did an interview with The Atlantic at the end of last year, and sort of the headline and sort of the frame of the interview was, you know, a man in the wilderness, you know, a man without a political home. And as I thought about that, you know, the thought occurred to me that the crisis for Christians is not that we're politically homeless, but that we ever thought that we could make a home in politics at all. And so I certainly felt an affinity for the president. I certainly thought that he had a positive vision for the role of faith in our politics. I think he put an emphasis on important themes, like the fact that people ought to be able to bring their faith to the public square at a time when we were starting to hear increasingly voices saying that faith had no role to play. The fact that he was willing to speak about things like international aid from a faith perspective. But by no means did I sort of go in thinking that we were sort of aligned on everything, and that we were in total agreement.
Okay. So one of the interesting things, let me turn now to just ask you to elaborate on a couple of statements in your book. This is on page 116 and 117. President Obama, I'm quoting here, repeated his openness to restrictions on abortion throughout the 2008 campaign. That he never took any action to propose or actively support such a restriction as president suggest that those statements were either little more than political posturing, or his intentions were overwhelmed by political calculation and compromises once he was president, end quote. Reflecting on this now, I mean, which is it, either or both? How do you think that through?
I was talking with a group about this recently. And one of the themes of that chapter, and by the way, this is a chapter 5 months into his administration, President Obama went to University of Notre Dame to call for reducing the number of abortions in the country. Following from that, there was a multi-year policy process that never led to what was hoped for and what the president had asked for, which was a unified policy proposal, common ground policies on abortion. A theme of that chapter is that pro-life groups never really held the president's feet to the fire on the commitments he made. So when he said that, when he told Christianity Today that he was open to restrictions on abortion, instead of what I think would have been the strategically smart thing to do, which is to, especially after he was elected and when he was in office already, if I was a pro-life group, I would have been running ads saying, okay, well, what abortion restrictions will you support? Instead, the pro-life posture was treat those words as so meaningless as to ignore them. Part of what happened was there was an expectation that the pro-life community wouldn't support him if he sought common ground, and he'd lose support on his left flank. And so it was hard to build and see the sort of political incentive structure that would make something like that feasible. Now, I would still argue at the heart of that sentence is it was still a commitment that was made. So what were the goals and motivations of making the statement, and could they have been followed up on in a more substantive way?
So your sense still is that that desire on his part was real. It wasn't. You give a choice here that it's political posturing or overwhelmed by political calculation compromises once he was president.
I pose the question because what is clear is that it was not followed up on. Is clear is that in the campaign he said that he supported abortion restrictions, and in office not only did he veto the ones that got to his desk, but he never put forth any restrictions, which if he said he supported some, then you would think that would be an option.
So that was disappointing.
Of course,
to you.
Yeah.
Okay. In 2014, a government report found that the administration has failed to enforce, not even tried to enforce, the rule regarding federal funding for abortion. The pro-life Democrats in Congress lost their seats defending what turned out to be a lie, that the president's commitment to health care reform would not result in federal funding for abortion. In this case, the Obama administration proved the cynics right.
Yeah.
So, just thinking back now, I mean, if the pro-life groups, you're right, I mean, were anticipating, assuming that it was all a lie, and we're not going to be taken in by it. Mm-hmm. But you're suggesting that actually they should have said, well, what if it's not a lie, and propose something, or...
No. Right, there's a... in the first case, what I'm arguing for is they should have treated the words seriously and made the administration put forward a policy proposal.
Okay.
In the latter, the policy was not enforced or even enforceable. No. Don't. I want to conflate the two arguments on that case. Look, we'll see. This happened a number of times where Democrats would respond with great offense and incredulity about any conservative criticism or questioning about Michigan. So how dare you say that President Obama supports gay marriage until he supported gay marriage, or how dare you say that healthcare will fund abortion until it funds abortion, as the government report, as their own government report laid out. You would think that report would have prompted a major effort to fix the policy, to match the president's commitment. This report came out when the administration was still in place, but instead, to my knowledge, media didn't ask. Frankly, there was very little. There was very little activity from pro-life communities. It was kind of like, well, that's kind of overdone. So it was a major. It was a major. Healthcare was. Remember, it wasn't the individual mandate that held up the passage of healthcare in the end. It wasn't any number of policies. The last move that had to be made to get healthcare reform passed was an executive order that made a commitment that federal funds want to go towards abortion. In my view, that means a lot is riding on that being true.
Okay, so the pro-life people tended to think from the start this was all the crock, and so they were not going to really hold his feet to the fire because they didn't think his feet were ever close to the fire. But the reporter should have been asking that question then, right? The contradiction between his statement and action, and no one did.
No.
I take it. Okay. The and then, I mean, similar. You mentioned that you spent a lot of time on this whole policy question about the birth control or abortifacient mandate. And with all the time you spent on it, said making it all the more devastating when the wrong decision was made. So tell us a little bit about that devastation. I mean, take us through what that was like, actually, you know, spending all this time and then...
It was something that took up a lot of time. And there was a lot of run-up to it, and the sort of the consequences and the political fallout was made clear. So it wasn't, I was not surprised, nor should anyone else have been surprised by the Fortnight for Freedom or by the religious react. In other words, this was something that was deliberated over. The stakes were made clear. And still, the initial decision out of the gate was made in the way that was, and it almost exactly what was predicted happened. So it was a disappointing moment. And of course, it's something that's still not over. And so there are still court cases now dealing with the mandate. The administration won multiple Supreme Court cases relating to the Affordable Care Act. What they lost were the cases relating to the mandate. And so, yeah, I think it was burned bridges might be a bit too far, but it certainly there were faith groups that had that were more cynical about the administration after that. After that decision was made, even with all of the adjustments and the sort of attempts to clean it up after the fact.
So, I was somewhat disappointed, by the way, compassionate conservatism that I had been involved in formulating, I suppose.
Right.
I was disappointed by the way it turned out in the administration. And then people who wanted to think well of me, perhaps over well, would say, well, you know, didn't you feel a little used in the process? To which I would tend to respond, well, I never thought it was very likely from the start. It was, this was, this was, you know, a hope, maybe, possibly. I mean, I'm sure you've gotten that type of reaction, too.
Beginning of the last chapter of my book, I reflect on this very question. What is clear is I was serving at the pleasure of the president. I'm proud of much of the work that we accomplished. But for both the good and the bad, the decisions are ultimately made by him. As I say in that chapter, reflecting back, there are clearly, I think I write, you know, emails I never should have sent or phone calls I should have made. You know, you go back and you think, had I approached it this way instead of that way, would the outcome have been different? And those are just things that you ruminate on. But that at the end of the day, I think, again, because I was in the faith-based office, because my role was kind of as a bridge between the administration and the faith community, I was in some ways protected from some of the more complex sort of questions. In other words, I wasn't the person who was signing off on or writing the mandate, or I wasn't the person who that wasn't my role. My role was primarily in outreach and in making sure that the views of the faith community were represented.
But did it end up really increasing the total of cynicism in the land, insofar as people who had, you know, probably utopian hopes, learned that there is no utopia there?
Well, if they had utopian hopes, then those were going to be disappointed regardless. In other words, I'm not sure that cynicism, that politics will effectuate utopia, is a bad kind of cynicism to have. I think right, politics is about you take two steps forward and take one step back, and so I'm sure that I'm not more cynical, sort of coming out of the process, coming out of the last 8 years. I don't know how other people have reacted. If we accept politicians lying, not being clear about their positions as a political strategy to advance our ends, then we undermine, that is a cause for cynicism. That is a cause for people to feel like, how can I even be a citizen? How can I engage in politics when you're putting the burden on the voter, not on the politician? You're putting the burden on the voter to discern in which case and in which scenario politicians are telling the truth or not, instead of putting that burden on politicians. So the troubling thing for me about that was not that the president changed his mind. If there was a change of mind that took place, the thing that was people applauding sort of the how astutely the change happened and how aides have come out saying it's a major part of his legacy that this change happened when he ran in 2008. And as I talk about in the book, it wasn't just that he was going to religious groups and saying that he supported the traditional definition of marriage. 3 days or less than a week before the election, he was on MTV telling a bunch of teenagers, which, you know, traditional, you know, generally support gay marriage. He was telling them, "I support marriage between a man and a woman." So it was a clear part of his campaign, and it's just something that we need to confront and reject, whether it advances our policy goals or not. We can't accept that it's okay to mislead the public.
So that is troublesome.
Absolutely.
That was political strategist Michael Ware talking with World Editor-in-Chief Marvin Olasky. This interview took place in 2017 at Patrick Henry College. Thank you for listening to this presentation of listener-supported World Radio. I'm Jill Nelson. See you next time.
The Olasky Interview is made possible by listeners like you. Additional support comes from Crown and Covenant Publications, publisher of the new book, God Breathed, by Rutt Etheridge III. For truth seekers in the age of the lonely self, this book will help you connect through Scripture to God, others, the natural world, and yourself. Available at crownandcovenant.com and on audiobook platforms.